On this edition of Jazz Profiles, it's a tribute to pianist Tommy Flanagan. He died in 2001, a year after this show was produced.
In junior high school, an art class, and a teacher used to ask students to bring recordings in for inspiration to paint.
Pianist Kenny Barron.
So a friend of mine brought in this recording, can't remember the title, but it was Miles Davis, Sonny Rollins. They played a Dave Brubeck composition, In Your Own Sweet Way. And I'm listening and I hear this pianist. I was just taken with his approach, his touch. It was a very, very light and delicate touch, and the ideas were so clear. And I'm saying to myself, who is this? So I asked my friend if I could see the album jacket, and I looked on it, and it said, Tommy Flanagan.
He was involved in some of the most important recordings of the post-bop era, playing with everyone from John Coltrane to J.J. Johnson, from Miles Davis to Sonny Rollins.
Tommy is a very resilient player. I mean, in other words, very well-rounded, and he's very adaptable, which is an excellent trait.
Some pianists have great harmonic sense, and some are great melodists, and some have wonderful time. And Tommy's got all of that. He covers all the bases.
He takes solos that, you know, just linger in your mind for months afterwards. Did you ever think about that solo that Tommy Flanagan played, you know?
His playing caught the ear of Ella Fitzgerald, for whom he became both pianist and music director, staying with her for over 12 years.
They knew each other musically very well. He and Ella together were like a meeting of the minds that just melted right into one and became one solid thing.
Oh, willow weep for me. Willow weep for me. Then your branches down around the ground that covers me. Listen to my plea. Listen, willow, and weep for me.
During his time with Ella Fitzgerald, Tommy Flanagan remained in her shadow, his public image somewhat obscured. But since reconstructing a trio in the late 70s, he's made scores of recordings and reached a worldwide audience through performing. With his quiet elegance and self-effacing manner, Tommy's been called one of the true gentlemen of jazz. I'm Nancy Wilson. On this edition of Jazz Profiles, it's a tribute to the pianist known as the jazz poet, Tommy Flanagan. Tommy Flanagan holds a well-worn seat on the long train of accomplished jazz pianist, jazz historian and writer Dan Morgenstern.
Tommy has always had the complete admiration and respect of his peers. I mean, if you talk to piano players and you mention Tommy Flanagan, they'll say, oh, you know, and go into all kinds of ecstasy. And that goes for players of other instruments as well.
Pianist Kenny Barron, who taught jazz at Rutgers University for 25 years, has always used Tommy as a model.
One of the things I'm very keen about in teaching is having students play ideas and not just play scales and chord patterns, but really play ideas. And Tommy is one of the prime examples that I use. I have them find all of Tommy's records and really listen to them and analyze them and really check out what he's doing, you know. Check out his touch. Check out his ideas. How does he negotiate through the chord changes?
For most listeners, one aspect of Tommy's playing stands out above all else. Pianist Roland Hanna.
Well, more than any other attribute, Tommy's touch is different from all other pianists. Tommy has a very long fingers, and he doesn't play a curved finger piano style as most people who spend a lot of time practicing classical music do. He plays a straight finger or flat finger style in the way that Vladimir Horowitz did. And as a result, he gets a special mellowness out of the piano that other people would not get.
I think it's pads on my fingers.
Tommy Flanagan.
I don't know, it's something I'm just unconscious of it. I don't know, it's just the way it comes out.
Elegance in his playing, very delicate, very clean, and every note you hear is crystal clear. It's like pearls, like little pearls.
Tommy has a sense of clarity, of making his musical lines mean a great deal. In other words, when he plays, it's almost like he's telling a story with his music. It's almost like he's saying things. You get the sense that the phrase that he made is a sentence or a word or a meaningful statement, you know?
Drummer Elvin Jones.
The thing is, it's an education to play with Tommy Flanagan. And when he starts to play, and you respond to it in a way that you'd never dreamed of doing before, because nobody else plays music like that. And so it's a very wholesome, invigorating experience to be involved with Tommy Flanagan on stage. Here's a great artist that you've got an opportunity to blend with, to fuse with in a way, and it's more like fusing with a great musical mind.
Elvin Jones and Tommy Flanagan go way back, over 50 years. They both spent their early days in a city that seemed to produce an ever-growing fleet of noted jazz musicians. Again, Dan Morgenstern.
Detroit in the post-World War II period was a mecca for modern jazz, and it was a very stimulating environment, and I think there was a closeness between the musicians from there, and a lot of camaraderie and shared experiences, and it's amazing to think of how many people came out of that city.
Detroit was a city that fostered musical interaction and nurtured young musicians, like Tommy Flanagan, who was born there March 16, 1930. The image of him as a youngster is still fresh in some people's minds.
When he was a young fellow, he was a handsome young guy. Had a lot of hair on his head. Had a lot of hair, had a lot of curly hair, and the ladies liked him. He was very popular.
Roland Hanna was a year behind Tommy in school.
We met at the piano at Northern High School. I heard Tommy playing. Tommy was only about 13, but he was a brilliant, precocious pianist.
I had a little talent, but I was, embarrassed by it, really playing. I mean, I could do it as long as I was behind a curtain. So that's how I first heard Roland in the school auditorium.
Tommy was further advanced than I was at that time. I was involved in trying to get Chopin etudes down.
And I could hear Roland, he was practicing his Chopin. And there was a dividing curtain. There was a piano on one side and one on the other. Roland came around the curtain, he heard me playing. He said, "Where's your music?" I said, "I don't have any music. I'm playing this from what I heard, you know. I'm trying to play something like Art Tatum." You know.
Art Tatum, with his remarkable harmonic sense and technical wizardry, was one of Tommy's idols. He listened to Tatum recordings brought home by his older brother, and then he tried to work the tunes out at the piano. This was Tommy's method for all the music he learned.
He could play all of the new music, Dizzy Gillespie, Bud Powell, Thelonious Monk, Charlie Parker, Sonny Stitt. That was new music then, and most of the people called it modern jazz.
During the late 1940s, while modern jazz was brewing in New York City on 52nd Street, the scene in Detroit was a little spot on the west side of town called the Bluebird.
I lived quite a ways from there, so it was quite a journey to get there, like a couple of buses. But I just knew that there was a good band working there, and I used to stand outside and just listen to the band, because the bandstand was right in the front window.
The core of the band was Elvin Jones, who's 2 years older than Tommy, and Elvin's older brother, Thad. Though Tommy was younger, the band did notice him.
I got a little reputation, this kid can play a little bit, So the piano player, he used to sneak me in before any of the older folks could have noticed anybody in charge there. I get a couple of tunes in, and then I'd split.
Tommy eventually took over as pianist. He began to garner the attention of both the Detroit musicians and those traveling through town.
Tommy was a guy who you could name any piece, any composition, and sometimes we'd test musicians in jam sessions like that. So let's play this, play this, play that. Tommy knew them all. He knew everything. Nobody could call a piece that he didn't know, no matter who it was. When we had visiting artists, Ben Webster and Buck Clayton and all these kind of guys. Couldn't rattle Tommy. He still, he knew everything that you could imagine. It's just amazing.
You're listening to NPR's Jazz Profiles, a tribute to Tommy Flanagan. I'm Nancy Wilson. Through the early 50s, Tommy gained both reputation and important experience, encountering many of the great musicians of the day. A gig with the local singer, Bobby Caston, afforded one memorable encounter.
One night I was sitting there doing something before she came on, a solo piece. And it was one of Art Tatum's things I was trying to play like him. And Bobby came over to the piano and she said, "Tommy, there is Art Tatum." He was sitting at the bar. I fell over. Anyway, that was a scary moment. I was in such awe of this man.
Tommy was also in awe of pianist Bud Powell, who heavily influenced his style. In 1956, Tommy got in a car with guitarist Kenny Burrell, and they headed east for New York City, determined to check out the bop musicians they idolized, Miles, Monk, Bird, and Bud. Not long after arriving, Tommy found himself in a position almost unimaginable. He was asked at the last minute to sub for Bud Powell at New York's hotspot, Birdland.
Broadway, 52nd Street, subbing for Bud Powell. Yeah, 2 weeks.
During that two-week gig, Tommy's first booking at a club in New York, all the locals came through to check him out.
I had a very good time and meeting a lot of people for the first time. Heavies, you know, like, used to be scary, you know.
I think I met Tommy Flanagan when he came to New York City for the first time from Detroit. I remember riding around New York City and Tommy was sort of looking at the buildings and all of this stuff, you know.
Saxophonist Sonny Rollins was introduced to Tommy by Miles Davis, who knew Tommy from Detroit. Within months, all three were in a studio, along with bassist Paul Chambers and drummer Art Taylor, for a now very historic Miles Davis session. It was a daunting crew.
Well, you knew you had to play your best. These guys always played. I thought they were at their best all the time. You just try to get to that level like they're playing. Somehow, we made a little history.
From Miles Davis, Collector's Items, this is Veered Blues, recorded March 15th, 1956. Tommy soon became much in demand as a studio musician, Sonny Rollins.
I liked playing with Tommy because Tommy was always a very sympathetic accompanist for me. Nobody wants a piano player, which is a very domineering instrument anyway, because it has all these keys and chords and so forth. So if you're a soloist, a piano can be too obtrusive, and it's often the case that a pianist can play too much so that it doesn't leave any holes, so there's nothing for a horn player to play.
In June of 1956, Sonny asked Tommy to play on one of his dates, which remains one of the best-selling jazz recordings ever, Saxophone Colossus. In Strode Road, Tommy's understated touch provides elegant contrast to the powerful statements of Sonny Rollins.
Thank you.
Sonny Rollins' Saxophone Colossus, with Doug Watkins on bass, Max Roach on drums, and Tommy Flanagan on piano. 1957 brought a strong relationship with another of history's great tenor saxophonists, John Coltrane. He recorded an album that year with Tommy called The Cats, followed 2 years later by Giant Steps, Coltrane's landmark recording, with Paul Chambers on bass, Art Taylor on drums, and Tommy Flanagan on piano. This is Spiral. Spiral from John Coltrane's Giant Steps, one of the many historic recording sessions featuring Tommy Flanagan after his fortuitous move to New York City in the mid-1950s. It was a period rich with experience. Not only was he playing with many of the most noted musicians of the time, but he also established his own name with his first Tommy Flanagan trio recording. As you'll hear, I'm Nancy Wilson. You're listening to Jazz Profiles, a tribute to pianist Tommy Flanagan from NPR, National Public Radio.
He has a kind of elegance in his playing.
Pianist Kenny Barron.
And I think that carries through in his demeanor. The way he looks, the way he acts, the way he dresses. I think all of that carries through.
He's known for his understated ways, his gentle manner, his soft voice. People have remarked on how quiet Tommy seems since he was a little kid. Tommy Flanagan.
In the family, they used to say he doesn't say anything. So I wouldn't say anything. And they say, see, I told you. I say, right. I showed him.
A wise man once said that a wise man listens, he doesn't speak.
Saxophonist Sonny Rollins.
So, you know, I think Tommy's not a quiet person, no, but I think he's not a person that always has something inane to say just to be saying. I think he's too much of a thinking person and a thoughtful individual, which is an excellent trait.
One thing sometimes you don't hear in his music so much is that Tommy is very funny. Tommy can be hilarious sometimes. You know, he can catch you off guard.
he can raise just as much hell as anybody else would.
Drummer Elton Jones.
It just depends on the company. You know, we used to have some pretty rough evenings. Especially traveling over in Sweden and around, you know, because they have this drink called aquavit, and if you're not careful, it can get the better of you.
Not only did Sweden offer good aquavit, but also a great recording opportunity. After 4 months of touring there with the J.J. Johnson Quintet in 1957, the Swedish record label Metronome offered Tommy a contract. Drummer Elvin Jones and bassist Wilbur Little joined him for his first trio recording, Tommy Flanagan Overseas. It's still considered one of his best, despite the obstacles encountered trying to make it.
It was done under terrible circumstances, you know, like the equipment was, you know, one microphone, like in the center of the ceiling. And we recorded in a basement of a place that had just been flooded out. A few days before.
Elvin remembers it a little differently.
What was flooded was us, because we had two bottles of Gordon's gin and two cases of this Danish elephant beer. And so we proceeded to drink all of that. And finally, we didn't play one of his compositions now, so he just named the composition, "All the Gin Is Gone." And it was. Under down our three throats. And all the beer, too, as a matter of fact. That was quite a date.
Charlie Parker's Relaxing at Camarillo by the Tommy Flanagan Trio, with Wilbur Little on bass and Elvin Jones on drums, recorded in 1957 on Tommy's first trio album, Tommy Flanagan Overseas. The late 50s were filled with recordings and appearances for Tommy, with a wide array of musicians. Particularly significant was a tour through England with the Coleman Hawkins Quintet. The headline act was Ella Fitzgerald.
I always thought she was about one of the biggest stars. Coleman Hawkins said to me, he said, I think Ella's been listening to you. And you'll perhaps get a call from her.
And it happened. It was the beginning of a great union that spanned more than a decade, during which Tommy was both Ella Fitzgerald's pianist and later music director.
And now it's with a tremendous pleasure and honor that we're introducing, first of all, on drums, Bobby Durham, Peter Betts on bass, Tommy Flanagan on piano, and the First Lady of Jazz, Miss Ella Fitzgerald.
Bassist Keeter Betts remembers when he joined the band in 1964.
Ella was very technical and ingenious. And Tommy had been with her long enough to go every place she went. So they left me standing on the dock. Damn. Who was that masked man and masked woman that went by me? I got caught between those two. I learned that. Heck of a lot. They could just go in and have tunes and bob and weave and so forth. And you had to be like a unit.
We got that together after a while, but it wasn't easy to begin with. I was trying to be so impressive, I was overplaying. She didn't tell me. I know. She could give you a certain look. She didn't say too much vocally herself about what she wanted, but somehow you knew after a while what she expected. I finally hit upon it.
Oh, Willow, weep for me. Willow, weep for me. Then your branches down around the ground that covers me. Listen to my plea. Listen, Willow, and weep for me. Gone my lover's dream, lovely summer's dream. Gone and left me here to cry my tears into the stream. Sad as I can be, hear me, Willow, and weep for me. Willow, 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 weep for me.
It's a very delicate art to accompany a vocalist. Keita Betts explains it this way.
To play with a vocalist, you now become a tailor. A gentleman comes in your shop, he's 6'3", and he wants a coat made, and he wants a double vent in the back. And then somebody comes in, another gentleman comes in, and he's 5'9", and he wants no vent in the back. Now, if you're a good tailor, you can make it fit each one of those and make a coat that when they walk out of your shop, it's custom made. But this is what you have to do as an accompanist, is to dress that singer for the audience.
And that's what Tommy did very effectively for Ella Fitzgerald.
If I should take a notion to swim, jump into that great big Atlantic Ocean, 'tain't nobody's business. 'Tain't nobody's business if I do. You hear what I say? And if I go to church, church on Sunday, come home and bow on 9 Monday.
He and Ella together were like a meeting of the minds that just melted right into one. It became one solid thing. They both tuned into each other. You know. They knew each other musically very well. He knew what she could do and she knew what he could do. It gave her a lot of freedom. And when he left, she was really upset.
In 1978, the grueling travel schedule, which had covered an average of 10 months of the year for over 10 years, finally took its toll on Tommy. During a tour through the south of France, he had his first bout with heart trouble, which led him to make the rather momentous decision to leave Ella Fitzgerald. but other issues were at stake as well.
The routine got to be too much of a routine. You know, you knew what was coming next, you know, even though as much as she could improvise and change things around, it was still, you know, she was the one that was doing it. It was feeling good to her, but I was, you know, well, I had had enough of just to playing that secondary role. You know, it lasted for a long time, and I enjoyed it, you know, while I was there.
You're listening to NPR's Jazz Profiles, a tribute to Tommy Flanagan. I'm Nancy Wilson. Rewarding as Tommy's time with Ella Fitzgerald was, it did obscure his public image. Writer and jazz historian Dan Morgenstern.
As far as the general public is concerned, there may have been a certain lack of awareness of who Tommy Flanagan really was, which isn't strange because for so many years, you know, he was, if not hidden, then at least not fully in the limelight.
In 1975, while still with Ella, Tommy had recorded his first album under his own name since he'd started working with her.
And that opened the floodgates because from then on, five albums in 77 and another five or six in 78. And then from then on, fortunately, we've had a healthy dose of Tommy Flanagan recordings under his own name. But it took a long time.
Maybe September, from Tommy's album Confirmation, released in 1982, with Elvin Jones on drums and George Mraz on bass. As Tommy reestablished his trio, his public image began to emerge from the shadows, particularly in New York, his home base once again. Not having to keep the rigid Fitzgerald travel schedule gave him the time to play again in New York clubs, like the legendary Village Vanguard, now owned and run by Lorraine Gordon and her lively staff. Lorraine's little office, which doubles as the kitchen, is covered with tattered pictures of performers that date back to the early days when Lorraine's husband, Max Gordon, opened the club in 1935.
They're all pictures that my husband was very fond of, and friends of his, and Bill Evans. And there's Elvin Jones, and there's the early picture Tommy with the mustache. That's very funny. It certainly needs a frame. It's falling apart. But nothing here gets touched. It's just the inner museum.
The main room of the club is a museum of photographs as well. Thelonious Monk, John Coltrane, Sonny Rollins, Miles Davis, and right behind the piano is a large, stately, black-and-white framed photograph of Tommy.
He says, what is my picture doing right in back of me, you know, he plays here. I said, because it's a beautiful picture and you look so beautiful and thoughtful there. And that's how he plays, eyes closed and into it, away from us. And you see the mustache is now white. The one in the kitchen was black, the picture.
Tommy's been playing at the Village Vanguard for over 40 years. He began with occasional gigs, moved to 1 week a year, then 2 weeks, twice a year. A rare frequency for any performer at the Vanguard.
And he has a wonderful following, and as soon as Tommy is here, they're all here, and he transforms the room into a truly great temple of jazz. People are quiet and beautiful and adore him.
Duke Ellington's Sunset and the Mockingbird, recorded live at the Village Vanguard on Tommy's birthday in 1998. One of Tommy's biggest fans, she rarely misses a performance, is Diana Flanagan, his wife.
Tommy likes to be close to an audience. I think he gets a lot of warmth and a lot of encouragement from an audience. And usually they really appreciate his humor and his presence, I think.
I like to interact with the people, you know, like just introducing the song, and it's like a little history lesson for the people to tell them where this song came from, who wrote it, and how it came to my attention. You know, I like to hear it myself, see if I'm, you know, just see how wrong I can be about what I'm saying, you know. And I have to catch myself a lot of times. I've strayed off the truthful path.
Diana is also very involved in helping Tommy organize his professional affairs. She fell into this role somewhat by chance, just by lending a helping hand where she saw a need. Now it's been over 20 years that she's helped make it possible for Tommy to keep a successful trio together.
And I really wanted him to have that, and it's not an easy thing to make consistent alone. I thought that would make him happiest, and it's made him very happy with his life as a musician, I think.
In January of 1998, Tommy gave a rare solo performance to a sold-out house at the Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts in Washington, D.C. ¶¶ Dizzy Gillespie's Ten Ten Deo, played by Tommy Flanagan in 1998 at the Kennedy Center in Washington, D.C. Tommy moves at a slightly slower pace due to ongoing heart problems, but he and Diana lead a comfortable life from their little apartment on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, where they've lived for almost 25 years.
You can't play really creatively, beautifully, if you don't have a love life, and you can't have a love life unless you can develop creatively, I think, for someone who's really an artist, you know.
For nearly six decades, Tommy Flanagan has weathered the changing climate of jazz.
You know, it's not easy out here, you know, like, just getting to your gig is a gig in itself, you know, like traveling, and even when you're in town, you know, it's always something, you know, obstacles in the way.
Saxophonist Sonny Rollins.
When people like Tommy Flanagan go around the world and the audiences are just hanging on his every note, you know, it must be difficult to know that you bring so much happiness to people, and yet you still have to struggle in, you know, in certain ways. A jazz musician has a hard life, but it's a societal problem which keeps jazz sort of boxed in a little corner. And it's very important to me to try to reach people and try to change the world with music. This is how we started out, thinking we could change the world through the force and power of the music. And this is now 50 years later, so I still would like to see that done, you know.
Tommy may not think quite so globally about his impact, but it is very meaningful to him to know that he's been able to give something to such a broad public.
I enjoy what I'm doing. You know, I guess I always will, because it's been happening for a long time. Music's not a job, it's a love. And it's good to know that somebody's receiving it, you know, like the way you're giving it.
Tommy Flanagan is just very soft-spoken.
Keeter Betts.
But when he sits down to the piano, then he speaks loud. He thinks loud, and he speaks loud, and he speaks his mind.
Elvin Jones.
There's no person on earth that I care more about than Tommy Flanagan. I have that feeling for him. It's just pure love.
Dan Morgenstern.
He's a wonderfully warm and gentle person who is dedicated to his art and who has enhanced other people's music all his life, and he's finally getting some of the credit he deserves in his own right. He's one of the true gentlemen of jazz, and just a wonderful human being.
Our tribute to Tommy Flanagan was written and produced by Molly Murphy. Post-production engineer, Andy Rosenberg. Jazz Profiles is produced by Tim Owens. Assistant producer, Madeline Smith. Senior editor, Greg Fitzgerald. Website coordinator, John Murph. Recording assistance provided by Basil Abbott from the NPR Bureau in Chicago and Michael Schweppe and Sean Fox from NPR headquarters in Washington, D.C. Special thanks to Diana Flanagan, Lucille Rollins, and Keiko Jones. To email us or for more information about other programs in our series, contact us through NPR's homepage on the World Wide Web at npr.org. That's npr.org. Major support for Jazz Profiles comes from the Wallace Reader's Digest Funds, seeking to enrich community life through support of education, arts, and culture. Additional support has been provided by the National Endowment for the Arts. I'm Nancy Wilson, and this is NPR, National Public Radio.
You've been listening to a tribute to the pianist known as the jazz poet, Tommy Flanagan. He died in 2001, a year after this show was produced. Discover more great jazz at NPR Music, including our new series, Live at the Village Vanguard, live webcasts and archives from America's premier jazz club. Check it out at nprmusic.org.